The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week I gave a talk about intention, and intention I see as kind of in the family of desires. And I thought I would talk a little bit today about desires. And in general, I think in the general popular view of Buddhism, kind of a caricature of Buddhism, it would be that Buddhism teaches that desires are bad, and the point of Buddhism is to become free of all desires. And I think it's a terrible caricature, because to do away with all desires probably just makes you depressed. The desires are intrinsic to being a human being. There would be no humanity, our humanness wouldn't exist without desires. So much so that perhaps rather than calling ourselves human beings, we should be called human desirelings because of its role. But because it's so intrinsic and so deeply embedded to what it means to be human beings, to have desires, it's very important, very worthwhile to look into what it is to have desire. What is desires? How do desires work for us? And I think that's a task that not a lot of people do in a deep way. Too many ways in which the desires operate in us go unexamined and unquestioned. And part of the task of mindfulness, part of the task of developing insight, is to have insight into how our desires work, the nature of those desires, the costs, the problems with desires, and also the benefits of desires. So rather than kind of starting off with the idea that desires are bad, I think the beginning place in Buddhism would be desires should be investigated, should be understood more deeply. And since it has to be a personal investigation, you can't really read a book or listen to a Dharma talk and think, oh, now I got it. Because it's really a matter of reading the book in you, understanding how it works for you. And I think for different people, desires operate different ways. And so, or different ways they're understood. And so if you're not careful, if you kind of make general statements about desires that like this, then it might be true for you, but it might not be true for other people. So really, you know, study ourselves, find out what's going on for you. So I'll offer some thoughts or some perspectives or some ideas about investigating desire today. And then, you know, maybe that give you some perspective to study yourself. So I think it's helpful to look at the word desire as an umbrella term. It's like the name of a family. It's a family name. In the classification of animals and plants, they have, you know, there's, how does it go? There's species, there's genus, family, and then species. Yeah, here we go. So the word desire is more like, you know, maybe like the genus or the family or the order. And then there's all these different kinds of species of desire. And so we have to look at all the different kind of species and kind of understand the different kinds to have a categorical idea about desire. You know, just is too abstract because there's so many different types. The word desire, so, you know, it's an umbrella term. So we have, so when I look at desire, use that umbrella word, I kind of like to divide desires into two general types. Those desires that fit under the genus name of craving, and those that fit under the genus name of aspiration. And there we could, you know, there's a fork. We go through our life, and we're always at a fork. And the question is, what kind of desire is going to operate in any given fork that we find ourselves in? Do we operate under something like craving, or drive, or drivenness, or clinging? neediness, or do we operate by what I like to call aspiration? Aspiration, I like this word because it comes from the word breath, to breathe, and aspirate, you know, and to have an easy, relaxed breath, to be at ease in this life, and then to allow motivations, intentions to come from some of the depth of our life when we're relaxed, I think is a beautiful thing. And I think some of the best qualities of human being come out when we're relaxed and we're breathing easily. And so there's aspiration, which is quite beautiful, to live a life of aspiration, is to live a life, I like to think of it as some of our deepest intention or coming from our goodness. So we can look at these two genuses and try to understand both of them and their role in our life. So there's a side of craving, which Buddhism sometimes doesn't use the word, has a lot of words like craving, but one of the most powerful or significant words in Buddhism in this regard is thirst. And so thirst, the word is tanna, thirst is defined or described as the condition which gives birth to our suffering. And if you want to question that and have some doubts about it, that's okay, that's part of your investigation. But you can say it the other way too, that in Buddhism, if you're craving, if you're clinging, then you will suffer. You can debate whether you're suffering, whether all your suffering comes from craving, but Buddhism says you can't really debate whether all your craving produces suffering, because craving itself involves suffering, involves some kind of distress, some kind of pain, contraction, tension. Because craving or thirsting involves a kind of drivenness, a kind of tightening around, where there's an urge inside of us that kind of has pressure in it that often leads to frustration. Like, this has to happen. You could have a wish to drink. You can feel thirsty in a kind of easy way. Or you could crave alcohol. And you're not necessarily thirsty for more liquid when you're craving alcohol, but that, you know, when you're thirsting for alcohol, I think we often then kind of see that's shading now over to addiction, one of the species or subspecies. And that often has a huge territorial range. Part of the investigation of desire is to look at those desires which bring about discomfort. And what's the nature of that discomfort? What's the nature of those desires that have a downside to them? And so there's a number of downsides to living a life or having a lot of craving or thirsting or clinging around our desires. One of them is that it produces tension. And that tension can be physical. Attention can be kind of connected to emotions. It can also be connected to our minds and our thinking. Our thinking can get quite tense when we're really focused and intent on something with craving. Frustration itself, I think, or this is kind of also not so far from perhaps fear. And I read recently that when they've done neural scans of the brain, that the parts of the brain that lights up when there's desires are the same part that lights up when there's fear, which raises the interesting question of what's the connection between desire and fear. But so craving itself, you know, we have this demand or this drivenness that's pushing us, is easily produce frustration. It can produce fear if we don't get what we want. There's also craving can produce alienation, disconnect, living on the surface of our life. Because when we're kind of in the thralls and caught up in craving, desire, pushed around by it, we often live it like we have blinders on. And some of the desires that people are really attached to, clinging to, sometimes don't really represent something that satisfies or meets the deepest parts of our lives. Sometimes it does. But so, for example, you know, some of the various things people can be addicted to, we have a society which has a huge addiction issues. maybe it's been true in all societies, but I think that it often leads to kind of alienation, kind of separation, where from others, from feeling connected to others well, to oneself really well. Sometimes the pursuit, the desire for pleasure. Pleasure is only kind of surface deep, and doesn't go as deep into us as happiness, for example. So if our desires are pursuit of pleasure, it often doesn't go that deep. Or if desire for status, you know, to be the hottest person on your block, you know, that's nice, but it's not that, doesn't go that deep, perhaps. And so, so you know, to be caught in the net of craving, of clinging, can lead to a kind of alienation, separation, disconnect. The also, to be caught in the net of desire and clinging can lead to a lot of poor judgment. And so many people have made huge mistakes in their lives, acting on a seemingly innocent desire or on a compulsive desire or a desire that was unexamined or unthought about. And later they say, what was I thinking? And, you know, there can be all kinds of problems that can arise because of it. So it's interesting to look at some of our desires, those desires that have more compulsion behind them, or we feel driven by them, and feel the lack of freedom there. You know, that there's something inside of us that's driving us, pushing us to act, sometimes even against our best judgment. It just sometimes the strong, strong drives are there. Sometimes because these desires are connected sometimes to our biology. And so it's quite fascinating to study. Where do any desires come from, and which come from our biology or from some deep and non-reasoned place within us. And some of it is quite maybe beautiful, the non-reasoned forms of desire. Now if I kind of step back and stop looking at craving, it seems that some people, if they are, they've done studies with children like this, but if you leave people alone and let them be relaxed, and give them a buffet full of different kinds of food, there can be a strong tendency to choose those foods that satisfy the nutritional needs that a person has. So, like pregnant women, it's very clear sometimes, you know, there's strong desire for certain kinds of food, maybe because they have certain deficiencies because of the pregnancy or something. Sometimes it can be strong, there's kind of an inner feeling or sense that this is the kind of food that I need right now. Sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not. But, but you know, there can be this feeling inside, and so the desire for certain foods might be prompted by some deeper biological understanding of what's needed, and so it might not be reasoned. You might not understand the reasons for it, but you feel this urge. And there's some wisdom to it. And then, you know, but there's biological urges, like there's a wonderful and powerful and dangerous biological urge to have children. You know, and that's gotten us so far, this far, you know, down through the centuries. We've all somehow, that urge has somehow brought us here today. And so it certainly has its place, but it can be so powerful, that urge, you know, and it's not exactly reasoned, you know. I mean, I remember when I was 14, and, you know, I didn't really have a reasoned understanding for some of the things I did. I just, like, you know, it was like the horse was out of the barn. It was galloping, and it was unexamined. They're just, this is what, you know, the hormones were telling me to do. And so, how many of our desires are unreasoned? How many of them are, some people say unrational, I like the word unreasoned, and they come from these deeper places within us, urges within us. The fact that they arise from our biology sometimes, does that mean that they should be, that they're justified and that they should be acted on? Probably not. But what I think they should be, I feel, they should be respected. Rather than kind of being dismissive of desire, I think that it's desires, you know, are kind of like a force of nature. And there's certain kind of respect and reverence that you can have for it. Sometimes the kind of respect and reverence you might have for watching a beautiful sunset, or going up into Yosemite and seeing, you know, in the summer, and seeing, you know, the beautiful waterfalls and Half Dome and things. And sometimes it's a kind of reverence and respect that's you should have, not for a sunset, they're beautiful, and Yosemite in the summer, but maybe Yosemite in the winter during gale storms. You know, it's beautiful and powerful and awe-inspiring, but you better be careful. So to have, you know, this respect, deep respect and reverence for desire, I think is a beautiful thing, but then there has to be the wisdom to know what to do. So on one hand, there's this you know, genus of desires that Buddhism will call thirst or craving or have clinging as part of it, that in the strong versions of it becomes addiction or compulsion, obsessions. On the other hand, there is desires which I like to call aspiration, which, you know, maybe comes from desires which are beneficial for us in some deep way. Like, so compassion, for example, is a desire. In Buddhism, the idea of compassion is a desire to alleviate suffering. It's celebrated in Buddhism as a really beautiful and profound desire. The desire for liberation, the desire to be free of suffering, is a beautiful desire. What other kind of beautiful desires are there? Perhaps the desire for security and safety is a healthy desire to have. The desire for self-esteem, certain kind of inner personal dignity, integrity, is a beautiful desire to have. The desire for peace and well-being, the desire to be supportive of our community, to leave the world a better place, is a beautiful desire to have. And, you know, some of these desires operate in a big way. Some of them are really, really small. I mean, if you come out of your house in the morning and your neighbor comes out of her house in the morning and you would like to know how she is, how are you? That's a desire. You know, we don't want to do away with that kind of desire. The desire for knowledge, the desire to be connected or know someone else, I think can be beautiful things. But all beautiful desires, all wonderful desires, are desires that we can cling to. So the fact that something has a beautiful purpose doesn't mean that we're out of the woods of suffering. Because how you hold your desires is a really important issue. And this is one of the places to explore, is not what are you desiring, and then you know, is it justified or not justified to have this desire? Do I deserve this desire or not? But rather is, how do you relate to having that desire? Is it a desire that you feel compulsion and absolute need that it has to be fulfilled? Or do you hold it lightly so that you have a desire, and if it happens, great. If it's easy to make it happen, great. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't really change your ease, your inner sense of peace and well-being. You can breathe just as easily with or without it. And so, the task of Buddhism is not to do away with desire, but to help free us from the compulsions we might have in relationship to our desires. The kind of way which we relate to desires, that we relate so it's a setup for frustration. It's a setup for suffering and pain. So even when there's beautiful desires, they're well-reasoned desires, we're confident that we're not causing harm to other people and living on those desires, we could still relate to that desire very tightly in a very constricted way. So then part of what we do in investigating desire is try to understand, how am I relating to desires, and what am I investing in my desires? Why am I relating to desires? What am I trying to get out of having these desires? So there can be the desire, for example, to, simply the desire to understand your neighbor a little better. Be curious, how's your neighbor doing? You ask how you're doing. And you can look, well, why am I asking this? Why am I asking this? Maybe you're asking because you want to use the leaf blower. And you would like to use it when your neighbor's not home. Or maybe you want to use the leaf blower and the last time you used it, your neighbor yelled at you in a ferocious way. And so you're afraid of the neighbor. And you don't want to use it, you know, the neighbor's going to be home. So you're asking out of fear. Or maybe you're asking because you really want to ask your neighbors, all your neighbors, how they are, because you want to be recognized as a saint of your neighborhood. Or perhaps, you know, or perhaps you're asking because you can get the latest gossip. And then you can tell your other neighbor. You know, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, the desires aren't necessarily innocent. There can be desires behind the desires. There's motivations behind what we're trying to do. And that's why in Buddhism, one of the emphasis of Buddhism is to look at the intention, the intent, not just look at what we're desiring. Because desire itself sometimes is the front man for deeper intentions. So sometimes when someone asks you or tells you, I want something, the beautiful question can be, for what purpose? What's your intent in wanting that thing? And that's a way of kind of exploring more deeply rather than just taking the surface of what's going on. So aspiration, I think, for me, comes from breathing. The word breathing, like respiration. And so is there a kind of place or a way that desires can arise within us where they arise from some place that we think is valuable or beautiful, a place of ease and peacefulness, a place where how we find our way through our life and get our needs met, take care of this life we live, the desires to do that do not limit us, do not frustrate us, does not constrict us. But rather, those desires arise out of a sense of freedom, with a sense of freedom. We can take it or leave it. And it's possible to be very motivated, extremely motivated, and do a lot of hard work, and at the same time hold the intent, the aspiration, very lightly. It's possible to have tremendous sense of purpose to accomplish something and not be attached to the outcome. And it's possible to be attached. And so part of what we do in Buddhism is to look, how am I holding this? And do I need, is it required to hold on tightly? Is it required to, you know, to look, to keep looking? So then part of this investigation into desire is also to learn, how do we hold desire? How do we, we'll relate to it, but how do we bring our mindfulness and practice to desire so that desires we can be wise and free with our desires? Because to have desires which have compulsion with them, there's very little freedom. So what does it mean to have the heart free and still have wishes? So it takes a lot of mindfulness. And so part of the role of this practice here is to look at desires. But it's hard just to look. What helps a lot with strong desires is to feel it in your body, to drop down and feel what's going on physically when there's compulsion, desire, to feel what's going on physically when there's aspiration. To not be blinded by the object of the desire. One of the functions of mindfulness practice is to help us stay grounded in our subjective experience. What easily happens when there's a desire, involves wanting something. And because it has an object to our desire, sometimes we get blinded by the object of what we want and we lose touch with our subjective experience when we're having the desire. And so part of the function of mindfulness is to come back and feel the subjective experience. How am I right now as I'm having the desire? Because if you can feel your subjective experience, then you have access to a lot more wisdom about what's really going on. Very simply, part of that wisdom is you can notice the cost to you for having that desire. You can notice the effect that it has on you. And it's possible to notice that desire has a deleterious effect. And if you really feel that, you'll feel, you know, what I want is not worth it. Because it's that, you know, the amount of stress that I'm having. Or you can feel how beautiful it is to have desire. There seems to arise in some easy, like a beautiful fountain of wishing that is, you know, just is there in a free, light, floating way. And if the circumstances are appropriate, it's beautiful to act on it or not. So part of the function of mindfulness is come into our body so that we can feel the subjective aspect of what it's like to have a desire. So we learn a lot from that. Another very important part of mindfulness, as we kind of stay in the subjective experience, means we stay in the present moment. The subjective experience is always in the present moment. And the present moment is the only place where you can choose what to do. If you really want to have some choice, choice only happens in the present moment. The less you're in the present moment, the less you have access to your capacity to choose, to make a choice. And so mindfulness helps put us in the present moment. And then one of the great capacities, great choices that hopefully you can make that represents your freedom and not your oppression, is the choice not to act on a desire. If you to have that, that's one of the really significant choices we can make. You might not be able to choose what desires come up, but you can choose whether you act on the desire or not, whether you pick it up, whether you allow it to kind of course through you and drive you and push you. And so part of the function of mindfulness is to teach you how to let go of the compulsions, let go of the drive, so that the desires can maybe be there, but we're not invested in it. We're not identified with it. We're not attached to it. Some people get very upset about this idea because the idea of not being attached to desire sounds like, you know, like then there's nothing. Yeah, you're not going to act. You're not going to want anything. And I'm suggesting that it's different than that. I'm suggesting that you can still have desire when there's no attachment. But if there's no attachment, then you can be, there's much more opportunities for you to be wise about how you act on the desire. If there's attachment, there's probably not going to be much as much opportunity for you to be wise, reasoned, to be considered, to be heartfelt in exploring the nature of this desire. So mindfulness helps us to be to see the cost, see where it's coming from subjectively. It helps us to see and study desires more carefully, and it helps put us in the place of choice. Or it helps show us where we have no choice, where we've lost our freedom. And then when we see where there's no freedom, then we can be inspired to practice. We can be hopefully inspired, have the aspiration to find a way to live freely, to discover a kind of inner freedom, to have the heart set free and not contracted, not driven. And it's one of the most beautiful things to experience in this life is a mind, a heart, which is really free of any kind of attachment or clinging to any kind of desire whatsoever. Rather than being a diminished life, it's an enhanced life. And one of the, because there's a greater sense of well-being, greater sense of peace in that freedom. And one of the great desires, healthy aspirations to have, is the desire for well-being. Peaceful, stable, open, relaxed sense of well-being. Which some people, you know, call different things. But one of the things I like to call it or refer to it is as integrity. To feel that we're integral, whole, complete. That we're not fragmented or divided against ourselves or divided against this world. To be in the world in a whole, relaxed, open, full way. And so the best of our desires can inform how we live our life. We can't live our life without desires, but we can live our lives without clinging to desire. And I think that's part one of the huge tasks of mindfulness practice, to show us and teach us that capacity. So maybe that gives you enough kind of ideas, maybe too many, of something that you can explore on your own now And that's really my hope and wish for you in my intention in giving this talk, is to give you some kind of material so you'd leave today inspired to spend the week exploring and thinking about the nature of your desires and your relationship to desires and the different kinds of desires. You can do a classification tree. And you know, put them all together. Maybe you know, Gil didn't have it right when he just said there's, you know, two classes. You know, the craving class and the aspiration class. Maybe you have more classes in your ecology. And so how would you classify them? How would you understand your desires and what your relationship is to them? And what are the effects on you? What are the consequences and the costs in you on acting on these different kinds of desires that you can have? So I'd really encourage you, I hope that that's the result of today, is that you'll think about it some. And one of the great things to do, I think, is also is to go find some friends, wise people you know, and also total strangers, you can talk to them about this issue of desire. Ask them, what do you know about desire? What have you thought about it? And so kind of so they be involved in conversations, so kind of pull out and explore it more fully that way. May each of you have fun with your desires. So we have a couple of minutes before the end. If anybody has any questions about this you'd like to ask, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Thank you. I get a beautiful image of this way of being with desire and holding it lightly. And then I'm trying to apply it to a real-world situation. I find my greatest strength is in my passions for things. Right now, as you know, it's starting this new school. And the passion gives me the energy to do it, even when I'm tired, and to just wake up in the morning and go for it. But I don't know whether that's a contracting thing or an expansive thing. I don't know where that fits. I don't know if that's healthy or not. Can you help me understand?
No. The only way I can help you maybe understand more than I've tried to do in this giving this talk is to put a mirror on you and help you to look more deeply at yourself, to really understand what's going on in your body and your heart and your mind. Meditation is a great mirror. So it's beautiful to have a strong passion for something and we really want to do something. And so you know you're holding it lightly if when you sit down to meditate, you can put it aside. But if it kind of follows you everywhere you go and the drivenness, and then you know you're probably somewhat attached.
Thank you. So that means I have my good weeks and my bad weeks. Thank you.
So this is a group of people that doesn't, except for Carla, doesn't really have any issues or questions around desire. Maybe you're not a desire type people. It's not really relevant.
Thank you, Gil, for your talk. And I'm struggling with sleepiness right now because my desire is in conflict with my neighbor's desire. And he seems to be making lots of noises. And so I think that's really my struggle with, trying to work with my own desire for peace and quiet in my house versus, and acceptance and, you know, and then working with when my desires are in conflict with other desires, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that, no question there, but in that looking at this kind of issue, perhaps it's helpful to drop this word desire because of how abstract it is. You know, it's this huge, umbrella term, and then try to understand more particularly what kind of desire is it? Is it, you know, is it a wish, an aspiration? Does it arise out of need? Is it connected to your biology? You know, that you need actually more sleep, and this is actually a problem for you not to get enough. And does it come out of, is it, what's it connected to? And look more deeply for you. It's connected to many things within you. And so sometimes there can be a healthy need to get enough sleep, if that's what's going on. And that can be a healthy thing to want more sleep and not be disturbed, have your sleep disturbed. But it can also at the same time be connected to maybe some unnecessary attachments. So, for example, it could be that you want more sleep, which you need, but part of wanting more sleep is that so that you can go out and spend time with your friends without looking like you're dragging, because then they'll judge you negatively. And so how you look, looking good is so important, right, in our society. So you want to look good, and how can you look good if you don't get enough sleep? So then all kinds of social issues are creeping in. And then there's issues of self-righteousness that come in when our neighbors make a lot of noise, our sense of justice. And so then there's a desire arising out of, even though we call it desire, hostility and aversion is a form of desire. Right? So what is it? What form does it take? And then, part of that is, just differentiating between needs and wants. And, we have needs. And then the question is, how do we pursue our needs in an appropriate way for ourselves so we don't suffer in the pursuit of it? And how do we pursue our needs in a way that, in a way that works or is appropriate with the people around us? So how do you, is there some way of talking with your neighbor, some way of sharing your need, your situation with your neighbor, some way of finding a way that both of you can coexist? And it might be, sometimes it's not the issue of the noise might not be really the real issue. The real issue is, how do two human beings relate to each other? Do they relate to each other with respect or not? And perhaps, the issue of the noise is a cover or, is a surface thing for something deeper, which is, the decent, ordinary respect that human beings should give each other is not occurring. This person's completely dismissive of the fact that there's a neighbor. And that's the kind of, the deeper issue and what might be where you're more, caught sometimes than the noise. So I don't know if this is helpful, but just, there's so much to explore, and it's worth exploring. And if you have the luxury, and if you don't have the luxury, you talk to the department manager. Okay. So,
if you have time for a question.
Well, it depends how long the answer might be. Which I guess is up to me. So,
yeah, it's on the subjective state. You talked about holding onto the state of silence. One thing I'm curious about is, when you're physically fatigued, the mind tends to get flooded with negative thoughts and emotions. And I'm just curious about...
What kind of thoughts? What was the adjective?
Negative thoughts and emotions when you're physically fatigued.
Yes.
I'm just curious if we can shed some light on that.
Well, I think stress is uncomfortable. And when we're uncomfortable, it tends to... discomfort tends to produce impatience, aversion, hostility, frustration. And so those things are often then produce negative thoughts and emotions, further things like that. One of the great parts of training in Buddhist monasteries is the discomforts that are part of that training. And one of them is sometimes not getting enough sleep. Now, it's important to get enough sleep, but I found it also very useful to practice in situations that were quite uncomfortable, so I can really see these things and how my mind works and find a way to be fatigued, to feel uncomfortable without it creating negative feelings and thoughts. If you're always shying away from being uncomfortable, then you might not do the inner work to really understand how to relate to this stuff differently. One of the things, I mean, this is a little, you know, jumping a little bit, but in that craving and clinging, especially like addiction, keeps us kind of on the surface of life and feels us not so deeply connected. There's something that often feels, I believe, feels uncomfortable about that. And that very discomfort sometimes will be a catalyst for wanting more. And so there's sometimes going to be this loop, self-reinforcing kind of pattern, where like addictions, the search for pleasure, isn't that deep. It kind of leaves us kind of unsatisfied. The lack of satisfaction, if someone doesn't know any other way of getting satisfied, will prompt them to want more sensual pleasure, more drinking, more drugs, more something, which makes them even more dissatisfied, and then they pursue more of it, and it just becomes more and more until they spiral out. So anyway, so it's a good question, and my answer wasn't what the question deserved, so we'll leave it for that now. Hopefully you're not frustrated. So there is this tea. You're welcome to stay and hang out. It's very nice to hang out. And this nice weather, you can take your tea and your snacks outside if you want. And some of you are new here today, and so you're welcome. You're very welcome to stay. And if those of you who have been here before come regularly, notice that there's someone around here who seems kind of new, or you think is new, or you know, say hello to them, welcome them. So thank you.